Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your one and only host today, Ursula Rudenberg. Pleased that you tuned in today. I hope you will spend the next hour with me. It's another beautiful, mild day with highs expected to be at 77 degrees today, and it should be about the same tomorrow, but cloudy, and by Friday, rain with possible thunderstorms are predicted. Next week has predictions for higher temperatures with highs all the way up to 88 degrees by the end of the week. Enjoy the rest of this week's mild temperatures, which, by the way, is great for biking. What better time of the year than now to think about biking? Stay tuned. Yesterday, a completed draft of the Ames Area Long Range Transportation Plan was presented for the first time, and the plan includes a more developed infrastructure and management of urban cycling. The plan is updated every 5 years and includes extensive citizen input. The chief traffic engineer for the city of Ames presented this plan yesterday, and he's able to join us later in the hour to tell us about that, together with a representative from the Ames Bicycle Coalition. We'll get a report from the Ames Bicycle Coalition on National Night Out, which involves bikes, fun, and police. It's Wednesday, so we'll have a regular installment of Tuning into Agriculture segment. I guess you could find a way to relate bicycles to agriculture, but we didn't manage to do that. So this week's Tuning into Ag is going to be about mushrooms in fall.
We build so many places for our cars, we don't always build places for people. It's been said years ago, Iowa doesn't have mountains like Colorado and doesn't have oceans like the coasts. We like to promote Iowa as the world capital of trails. We've got thousands of miles of trails in the state, and it's just amazing.
One of the things that Iowa can boast about is its cycling trailway system with more than 1,600 miles of trails. Lisa Hine is the program planning coordinator for the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation.
The Iowa Department of Transportation publishes a bicycling map for Iowans, and it outlines the traffic counts on the road. So if you want to use county road and bike on a low traveled road, so it gives traffic counts, and it also identifies where the trails are. And certainly folks can go to our website and look for trail information there. INHF.org, INHF.org, which is Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation.org. Folks can call our office. That number is 515-288-1846. 515-288-1846.
Last Wednesday, we spoke about the White Rock Conservancy bike trails. Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation is another of a few major land conservation organizations in Iowa that do dedicate themselves to protecting wildlife for the public trust. The Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation is a nonprofit organization that has existed since 1979, and it operates in the entire state to protect wildlife areas, parks, and groundwater. This has involved land acquisition and acquiring discontinued railroad corridors to build cycling trails. Some trails they facilitated are the Cedar Valley Nature Trail from Cedar Falls to Cedar Rapids, the Heritage Trail outside of Dubuque, the Raccoon River Valley Trail, or the Wabash Trace Natural Trail in southeastern Iowa. All of these trails are worth checking out, and they're easily found online, and we'll provide links for them on our website. The Heritage Foundation's greatest trail in our immediate area is a world-class biking and hiking trail, the incomparable High Trestle Trail. No doubt you've already seen the High Trestle Trail, and maybe you've been out on the bridge on a deep summer night to see this magical sight. If not, put it on your bucket list. Lisa Hine tells the story of the bridge's creation.
The High Trestle Bridge is part of the High Trestle Trail, and the High Trestle Trail runs from Ankeny through Slater, Madrid, over to Woodward. So it's 25 miles. The bridge itself spans the Des Moines River Valley between Madrid and Woodward. So it sits 13 stories in the air, and it's a half mile long. It was part of the Union Pacific Railroad Corridor that was discontinued in about 2003. when the railroad discontinued use, they took down the decking to use at their new bridge that was going in over the Des Moines River near Boone, part of their main line that runs through Ames. And so we were left with, I think it's 44 pillars across the river valley. So there were pillars that were left, but no way, no connections. So part of the project was actually having to rebuild the bridge surface and the bridge deck.
How did it become a bike trail and a hiking trail?
When Union Pacific Railroad planned for the discontinuance of that line, we stepped in to negotiate the purchase of that line for public use. And they provided a significant bargain sale to us, so they contributed a lot of land value. Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation formed a steering committee made up of representatives from Ankeny, Sheldahl, Slater, Madrid, and Woodward, and Story County, Boone County, Dallas County, and Polk County. So the steering committee worked together, and we helped guide them to find grant dollars to help build the trail. The first two sections built in about 2006 were a mile in Ankeny and a half mile or less in Woodward. And in 2006, Congress authorized a special appropriation for this project of a little over $5 million. That was the spark that really gave us the leverage to build a large section of it.
The view is very spectacular.
It is. And there's some neat geology from the Des Moines River Valley. The melting of the glaciers 10,000 years ago really helped carve the Des Moines River Valley. And there's also the coal mining history in there as well. And there's some interesting railroad history. Before they built the bridges, they had to go down into the river valley and kind of curve and come up. And a lot of times they would derail and they'd get down to the bottom and have to sort of haul one car at a time up the valley on the other side. So it was very cumbersome and slow going. And about 1912, the Milwaukee line, which owned the railroad at the time, came in and built all new bridges across that area. So there are some interpretive panels that are out on the bridge itself that tell a little bit about the natural history, as well as the cultural history, the railroad history of that corridor in the river valley. So folks will find that interesting as well.
And there's historical photographs of the bridge
itself. And there's a neat overlook, actually. That's the other interesting part about the bridge is on the west end of the bridge, there's a scenic overlook that was part of the first railroad bridge.
And I think by the overlook, there's a station where you can phone in for historical information.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Des Moines River Valley itself is spectacular, and this bridge would be a showstopper just because of Mother Nature and being 13 stories high over the Des Moines River. And the art just takes it over the top and it makes it a world-class icon now. The icing on the cake was the art. I got the idea of putting art on trail bridges from the folks down in Fairfield, Iowa. They're involving artists on their trail bridges. They got the idea from Tucson, Arizona. So I suggested to the committee, what do you think of this idea? Let's see about putting some art on the bridge. And they're like, sure, that sounds great. David Dahlquist, the public artist that you see a lot of his work across Iowa, did the concepts for what we call cribs, the square shapes that are lit up. There's a lot of coal mining history in this part of the river valley. So that square shape is based on what you would see entering a coal mine. And then he rotated it so that it would give some interest. There's pillars on each end, about 40-foot tall pillars on each end.
With coal on them.
Yeah, seams of coal that have been actually clay tile that Dahlquist created. And the cribs go across the entire bridge, but over the river valley, they're about 15 feet apart, and that's the part that's lit up. It rotates all across the bridge, but that part is very dense.
When you stand there at night, the cribs are lit up with thin blue neon lines. And when you stand at one end, the rotating images look like you're looking down a mine shaft. It creates an optical illusion.
Mm-hmm.
I never would have thought it would work with such a simple, such a simple construct of just some squares.
Mm-hmm.
But it really does.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. And I think the other exciting thing about this project is economic development that's occurred in some of the communities. There's folks from all over Iowa and the Midwest and the country that come to see this trail. I really look forward to the businesses in the communities being creative in getting trail users off the trail and into their towns. And Ankeny is trying to develop a whole new trail access point with a farmer's market area built around the main trail access point. So there's a lot going on. New restaurants in Woodward, and I think about three new restaurants in Madrid, a new restaurant in Slater. It is exciting.
How many people use the trail?
The bridge itself receives about 500 people a day.
Wow.
And there's probably about 300 on the rest of the trail, 200 to 300 people a day.
So what kind of things do people say about the bridge and that trail?
It's magical. I think that's probably the one thing I hear. It's just magical. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to describe. One time I was out there, and there was a gentleman from Coon Rapids, and he was in his upper 80s, and it was a very windy day. And the wind comes down that river valley a lot anyway. But he was walking, holding onto the railing, hand over fist, you know, walking into these 30-mile-an-hour gusts. And my husband and I came along and we're like, do you need some help? And he's like, no, this is the best time of my life. I'm having so much fun. I'm picking my ride up on the other side of the bridge, and I'm determined to get across there. And he was just having a blast.
Did the biking culture in Iowa take a step forward with this bridge?
Biking and walking and just being outdoors, that whole aspect took a big leap forward. Being way up high at the top of the river valley where you can be out there without any vehicles, it's just a wonderful way to experience nature and watch the birds fly above you and below you. And it's just Iowa outdoors, I think, took a big leap forward with this project.
One of the things that makes it magical is that you can't really drive up to it.
The easiest way to get there is to get on Highway 210, which runs between Madrid and Woodward and also goes through Slater. And just west of Madrid, there's a road called QF Lane, and there's a sign that says High Trestle Trail Parking. And so you turn south off of 210, and there's a parking area, and there's it's about a half-mile walk in to the bridge. Or you can take your bicycle, and it's wheelchair accessible. And there's even somebody in Madrid that has a supply of wheelchairs. So, like, for example, my mom, she's not in a wheelchair, but she's old enough that half a mile is a pretty hard walk for her. I can borrow a wheelchair and take her out there. That's the easiest way. Or you can bicycle. Heck, you can bicycle from Ames. You can get on a bicycle and take the bike lanes down the County Line Road, R38. That takes you to Slater. Get on the trail in Slater and bike all the way over to the bridge. Round trip, it's about 50 miles. It's a nice little Saturday afternoon bike ride for a lot of folks.
Well, thank you so much for coming. I've been speaking with Lisa Hine, who's with the Natural Heritage Foundation, which is based out of Des Moines, speaking about the High Trestle Trail. Okay. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, and in light of the beautiful weather, we're talking about the joy of cycling. That was Lisa Hine, Program Planning Coordinator for the Iowa Heritage Foundation, which gave us the beautiful High Trestle Trail and Bridge as a public trust. Lisa pointed out to me that cycling brings people and nature together. It's one of the benefits of the trails. It can also bring people together with other people in their community. On Tuesday, August 4th, the Ames Bicycle Coalition partnered with Ames Police Department to promote bike safety. This was an annual community building campaign called National Night Out that promotes community partnership and neighborhood camaraderie to make our neighborhoods safer places to live. Neighborhoods across the country host block parties, festivals, parades, cookouts, and other various events. Let's listen to what some of the participants here in Ames had to say about the event when it happened here.
Tonight we've got the Ames Police Department giving out bike helmets. We've got the Ames Bicycle Coalition doing free bicycle parking, giving away free bike lights. We got Ron Ritz from Skunk River Cycles doing free bike tune-ups and bike checkups. So Ron, how many years have you been doing bike tune-ups for people in the city of Ames?
I've been doing bicycles since 1972. Lots of free bike repairs under my belt.
How many do you typically do at an event like this?
Oh, I might do between 10 and 60. I think a couple of weeks ago I did one. About 60 bikes in about 3 hours. Okay. Two hours. I was pretty tired.
What's the most common bike problem that you see when people bring their bikes in and put them on your stand?
Number one is flat tires. Number two are incorrectly adjusted brakes. Number three, saddle incorrectly adjusted. Number three, could share it with chains. Too rusty, too greasy, too bent, wrong gear. But number one is definitely low tires. Tire pressure will lose about 5 to 10 pounds of pressure a week, so investing in your own floor pump would make it great. You can be the neighborhood king and rent your air to the neighbors. You can come see your local bike shop. We put air in tires for free. Or you can spend a lot of money on an electronic air compressor, but I suggest $35 for a real nice at-home floor pump. Works great.
So Ron, how long have you been selling bikes in Ames?
since 1972, 43 years.
How many bikes do you think you've sold?
More than 20.
Less than 1,000?
Oh, no, more than 1,000. I don't sell bikes. What I really sell is fun. The bicycles happen to be my way of accessing fun. You can do them 24 hours a day. You can do them winter, spring, summer, fall. You can do them out your front door. You can go someplace to do it. A bicycle is just, it's freedom in motion. It's like flight. It's like your chance to join the world as a bird on wheels. I love bicycles.
So you've been at it a long time. What do you think is the best thing that the city of Ames could do in the next few years to make bicycling better for its residents?
Bicycle infrastructure, better parking places would be great to make it more accessible for parking your bikes, and maybe more access to bicycle trails. Connecting the trails we have would be awesome, because there are a lot of these discombobulated spaghetti pieces that really don't relate to each other. Actually, maybe bicycle information distribution. So a lot of people ride bikes but don't actually know how to or where to ride bikes, so that would be useful. And maybe an updated... I really like paper maps. I could hand them out with each bicycle I sell for the City of Ames. And the little handheld devices like telephones or laptops, it's pretty hard to look at that when you're riding your bike. It might even be dangerous. But a map is pretty nice. And you can make little notes on it, like bad dog or cracks in sidewalk or things I can relate to the city and say, this needs repairing.
Talking with Eric Jones, who... runs or owns the bike surplus?
I run it for run a corporation it. In town.
Okay, great. How long have you been doing that?
7 years.
Okay. So what kind of repairs are you set up to do with this mobile station?
Pretty much anything. No internal stuff, but anything external on the bike we can get to through this. That usually requires a whole nother selection of tools we don't carry along with us.
Okay, so other than like an event like tonight's National Night Out, where do you roll around with this this rig and do repairs?
We started taking it out to the Trestle Trail, actually, just for kind of advertisement more than anything. Not really a money maker, but just getting out there and helping people out on the trail.
So you're doing that every week or every once?
We're trying to do it every weekend, at least once one of us go out there.
Now, are you biking from Ames or are you taking the rig partway?
Okay. We started Slater.
Okay, that brings up a great point. So one of the things the Bicycle Coalition is really excited about trying to do is get Ames a dedicated connection to the Slater High Trestle Trail Network. Mm-hmm. I think everybody who's biked on any kind of regular basis knows that R38 is kind of dicey for biking down to Slater. How awesome do you think that would be for Ames if we could get a connection like that?
It would be huge. You see how a small town like Slater or Madrid, what that's done for their economy in such a small town, just the amount of people it brings in. If you could connect Ames up to that, it would just be a huge boost to us as well.
The valet is going pretty great. We've parked right around 40 bikes overall, and we gave away all the bike lights that we had on behalf of the Ames Police Department.
So what exactly is a bike valet?
Bike valet is pretty simple. We put out some parking, and we allow people to bring their bikes in, and they can hang out here at Banshell Park or wherever you set up the valet. You kind of cordon off the area, and then for example, tonight we're here from 5 to 8, so at 8 o'clock everybody will come back. We've given them half of a playing card, so and attached one half to their bike. They'll bring us back the corresponding part, and that way they can enjoy their time at Banshell Park and not have to have bikes everywhere. And it's a good event for the Ames Bike Coalition, but also let people know what we do and encourage them to ride their bikes.
So people can ride their bikes and not have to lock them up. That's the big win?
Yeah, absolutely. Don't have to lock their bikes up. They can drop them off here, feel safe.
Now, do you think there'd be enough parking for all these bikes at Banshell Park if they actually did need to lock them up?
No, there's not enough. There's not adequate bicycle infrastructure at Banshell Park.
Speaking with Elizabeth Wenzel, who's here representing Kittical Mass and the Ames Bicycle Coalition, correct?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about Ames Kittical Mass.
Kittical Mass has been around for a couple of years. There's a family who got involved. This is a national organization, and they wanted to do family-friendly rides around the city of Ames. So once a month, we try to organize and get together with families and cruise the Ames area.
So how many people do you typically get for a ride?
It varies. Sometimes we get a small crowd, four or five families, and sometimes we get up to 10 or 15 families.
And how are the routes around town for doing a family friendly bike ride like that?
Well, we try to actually have kids familiar with riding on the streets. So we try to pick the routes that are identified as bicycle routes, you know, the street routes. Sometimes we take an officer, police officer with us for a little extra added safety. We talk a lot about safety with the families. Everybody's geared up with helmets and lights and all that sort of thing. But, yeah, we do plan the route.
Now, Ames has a lot of what they call shared-use trails. Now, if you're riding on those in a group ride, do you find that that is more difficult than riding on the street or riding in another fashion?
It's a little more difficult, yes, because we're a big group sometimes, and it's easier to be on the street and easier identified by
the... Is that because if you're on the street, you have your own lane just like a car, and so it makes passing and all the other types of things easier?
Exactly.
I'm talking with Bronwyn Beattie Hansen. She's here at the National Night Out event, and she is giving rides in her very unique pedicab. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the pedicab.
Yes, definitely. It is a unique piece of equipment, that's for sure. Ron Ritz from Skunk River tells me that it's actually, the word in Indonesia is becha. So it's from Indonesia. It was custom painted for Michael's Cyclery back in the 70s. And it is fun. It is a beast. So there's a bench on the front here, and the biker sits on back and pedals and steers the people on the front bench. And if I had to guess how much this thing weighs, I would guess maybe 400 pounds total. A lot of it is steel, so it's fun to ride around, but just if it's flat.
So was this in service in Indonesia or some other country, or was it just manufactured and then somebody in the United States bought it? Has it always been in Ames, or?
Yeah, so that's my impression is that it was purchased new and sent back to Michael's Cyclery, sort of custom painted, but wasn't used ever in commercial use in Indonesia, which is evident, I think, by how good of shape it's still in. If you used it for commercial use, I think it would have been a lot more battered.
So it looks like it'll hold two people. How's it to bike two people around in this big old thing?
Oh, two kids, much easier. Two adults is tricky. It's quite amazing to think that people do actually use models probably just like this for commercial purposes all over the world, because it is a beast, hard to bike, but doable with two people if you're... You've had some practice.
Hi, what's your name?
My name's Ray.
How long have you been riding a bike?
For about a couple months now.
Awesome. Are you going to bike to school?
Yes.
How old are you?
Seven.
Seven. Good job.
How about you? What's your name?
Lucas.
Lucas.
And how long have you been riding a bike?
For about 5 to 50 days.
5 to 50 days. That's amazing. And how old are you?
Five.
Five. Are you going to try to bike to school this year?
Oh, yeah.
Great.
I'm going to try it.
That's awesome. And how old were you?
Seven.
Seven. And are you going to bike to school this year?
That's great. Where do you go to school?
You bet.
Somewhere in Ames, right?
That's great.
Well, thanks for talking to me. Talking with Officer Patrick O'Brien, who was here at the National Night Out event. He was one of two officers who was handing out free bike helmets to people who needed them. And first off, why don't you give me an idea of how many bike helmets you gave away? It looks like you had a huge crowd.
Yeah, we did. We were just kind of doing the numbers on it. It looks like just under 200 helmets we gave away. And I'm not sure how many of the bicycle lights we had, too, but those were also donated, and we gave away quite a few of those with the help with Ames Bicycle Coalition.
And it looked like a few people were not able to get helmets, so... Probably next event we're going to have to shoot for 300 bike helmets. What do you think?
I think so. I think it would be good. I think we probably could have been giving away bike helmets for the next hour or so and would have been still a line.
Now, you do bicycle patrols around Ames. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We have a bike patrol team. It's regular uniformed officers that on occasion when we have enough people, we have a bike patrol. We have about 10 different bicycles. And so depending on the event and staffing, we get out and patrol. We do a lot more during special events, Visha, the football game nights, anytime there's going to be something like National Night Out here.
Now, when you do a bike patrol, you're doing a standard patrol. It's no different than if you were in a vehicle. Is it a special kind of patrol that you do when you're on bike? Or is there any differences between a bike patrol or a car-based patrol? Other than the motor transportation, obviously.
It depends. If we're doing a special event and we just need more bodies, it's just a quicker way. Like at the football game, sometimes we'll have them because it's easier to get through the crowds that way. But we train on doing traffic stops with the bike. you know, we train, do firearms on a bicycle too. So we can do anything we can do in a car, we can do on a bike as well. And we've got lights on there, but we used to have the red and blue lights on there, but they never really lasted as long. So we went to regular straight lights.
Now you mentioned that you've seen some, you know, issues with bicyclists when they're biking on the street. You've seen some issues when they're biking on the sidewalk. I know as an avid bicyclist that it's kind of hard to name sometimes to really know which is the best place to be, because it is a combination of, you know, street riding and, shared use trails. What do you think we could do in terms of transportation engineering or actual physical build outs that would help bicycling in Ames?
Well, I think we could do a lot more. I lived in Madison, Wisconsin for a while, and they have an excellent mix of the way they've incorporated bicycling and automobiles, and some of it is, you know, with the roads, they've got the specific bike trail, and I know that they're kind of moving towards that in some of the streets here in Ames, but I think if we had more of that, even if it was just built in, then it would raise the awareness of the bicyclists on the road. I wish there was more cycling in Ames and more ability to, but, you know, someone who cycles on the road too, I'm scared a lot driving during the day and at night. So I don't know exactly what the answer is. I know it's not as easy as just painting a line on the road, but I think we could do a lot more just to make it friendlier for cyclists. And I think that just would promote a better environment for cyclists and for motorists too, because I know that there are people in cars that get frustrated because cyclists, all they see are cyclists blowing through stop signs and things like that too. So I think there could be more that could be done on the education, on the engineering, with the traffic, and with the enforcement too, with us. A lot of times we see, you know, bicycle going by and we're not able to get out with all of them. But like I said, when I'm out at night and I'm able to talk to cyclists, and I'm not out there to, you know, write them tickets or anything like that. As someone who cycles, I want it to be a place where I can cycle safely at any time during the day. And so I'm just trying to educate people and make sure that they're aware of the laws and the safety issues that we have.
Have you noticed an increase over the last few years in people doing more like bicycle commuting, biking to work?
I think that, I guess I call it kind of like the bike culture is increasing, becoming more popular and more accessible to people. I think people see, I think in general cycling's, I like to think it's getting more popular and as a great way for people to get exercise. And I think there have been things that the city's done that have promoted that too.
What types of things would you say that they have done that have helped?
Well, I know that there are some streets, like if you go down Highland and things like that, there are some, there are the bike lanes. I think when we have events like this where we invite the, or when the Bicycle Coalition comes out, we have some really good shops in town that are really good about promoting it. If you go, you know, I think on campus I've seen more of an interest in people doing kind of the boutique bikes and the different kinds of cycling. Whether or not it's road cycling, or you see a lot more of the track bikes, you see a lot more of the single speed bikes, and people are just more interested in general, I think.
Now, do you get to take the police bike home at night?
No, I leave it here. There are occasions when I have ridden it back and forth to work, because it's a nice, it takes me about 10 minutes to get to work that way. But in general, we don't have quite enough bikes to cover for the number of officers that we could have on bike patrol, so I like to keep it available to any officer that's going to use it.
Great. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's Officer Patrick O'Brien. Thanks a lot.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg. When listening to these voices from National Night Out, I think it's clear that cycling is a growing factor in community life, and in many areas of life, from recreation to commuting to work to even to law enforcement. So yesterday, a comprehensive draft of the Ames Area Long-Range Transportation Plan was presented for the first time. This long-range plan covers Ames and surrounding areas that are expected to be urbanized in the next 25 years. It covers all of transportation, including transit, pedestrian, motor vehicles, and cycling. Cycling, if anything, is a growing factor, and so we wanted to talk about that aspect of the plan a little bit this morning. Damian Pregitzer, Chief Traffic Engineer for the City of Ames, is here with us to talk about that. And also Trevin Ward is here. Trevin is a spokesperson for the Ames Bicycle Coalition. So thank you for coming this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
This is a long-range plan that is updated every 5 years. It covers an area around Ames that it is expected to be urbanized within the next 25 years, as well as Ames itself. And Mr. Pregitzer, you were one of the people that presented the plan yesterday, is that correct?
That's correct, yep.
For starters, let's talk about who you presented it to. Can you explain briefly what the Ames Area Metropolitan Organization is?
Sure. The Ames MPO is going to be all the areas, again, that are within that area, the part of our Ames, part of the state, that we think will be urbanized, and areas that we think will be targeted for growth. So what you'll see is that it's Ames. The two cities are Ames and Gilbert. And then it also includes parts of Story and Boone County. The other representatives that you will see in there will be CyRide as a transit agency. They get special representation. And then also Iowa State University. Anytime you have a jurisdiction that owns their own roads that's within your MPO but is not a city, they're still a part of your MPO just as a special case.
Now, this plan really was a process where a lot of input was solicited from the public. I know there were hearings and there was an ability online to submit information. And so it's really been a long process. Can you describe what was actually proposed last night?
Sure. Last night was a summary of a lot, again, like you were talking about, a lot of history. What we do with the long-range plan is we start off with very high-level discussions about what are the goals for the community? How do we want to see our community and our area 25 years from now? So we start off with a group of public participation. It's going to be a lot of, like, workshop-style meetings with the public to talk about just any ideas that they have, any issues that they have. And then what we do is we start to focus some of those discussions down to specific projects that we would like to see and eventually get to costs. So what you saw last night was a very long evolution, I would say maybe 18 months worth of meetings and discussions that summarizes what we did. So the draft plan is what we presented. It summarizes all the public participation. It talks about the financing we expect to have for the plan, both local and federal money. Any grants we think we'll get in the next 25 years. And then we start to take our kind of our wish list, our desire list, like our projects that we really think are important we need to do, and we try and break them down into short, mid, and long term. Mm-hmm. And what those are going to be is the first 5 to 10 years of the plan is committed in short term. The next 7 years will be the midterm, and then the last 8 years of the plan are what we call long-term.
So can you focus on, for the purpose of this discussion, can we just talk about the bicycle part?
Yeah,
obviously,
absolutely.
This is a much bigger plan worthy of a long discussion. Mm-hmm. But today, can you just describe what was proposed in general terms for bicycling? Like, is there a transformation happening in terms of the importance of bicycling, and or is it kind of staying the same, or kind of what is the outlook on that?
Well, we certainly hope that we see a system that will transform Ames into a more bicycling community. What we're tried to do is break it down into two general groups, which mm-hmm. would be a green belt trail system, which was focused primarily on regional, like inside the city, and regional connections for recreation. And then the other half of that is that we're trying to focus on street facilities, which could be sharrows, on street bike lanes. We're going to maybe even try a new technique called advisory bike lanes that we're focused on commuting. And these would be the paths, the more direct north south east west paths, getting people to residential areas, to campus, or to wherever they might work. Or into commercial areas where they could go shopping and so forth. So we're hoping it's transformative.
So this is bringing in something that doesn't exist now.
Well, it's building on a lot of the good building blocks that we have in Ames. But one of the things that we noticed is that there's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of areas that are broken. That was the same with a lot of the feedback. So this plan is really trying to fill and make a complete network, I would mm-hmm. say, is one of the most the highest priorities, highest goals we're trying to achieve.
Okay, we're speaking with Damian Pregitzer, Chief Traffic Engineer for the City of Ames, about the long-range transportation plan as it applies to cycling. Trevin Ward is here as well from the Ames Bicycle Coalition. He's been representing the coalition on the questions regarding the long-range plan. Trevin, what were your priorities in approaching this plan?
So as Damien said, you know, we've got a lot of built infrastructure in Ames that actually serves us relatively well, but you know, things are very disconnected. You know, the analogy I've used is, you know, we wouldn't say that we have a great road system if we had fantastic roads and they all meant at gravel intersections, which is, I think, pretty analogous for the system we have in place. We have a lot of, you know, great side paths along major arteries where it's too busy to ride in the street. We've got some really nice greenbelt trails, but a lot of these components don't connect to each other. So getting that connected and getting a complete system was a real priority. You know,
do you feel this plan is responsive to the priorities that you've expressed?
Yeah, and I think that as with any kind of process, there are going to be limitations. There's, you know, we have to pay for all these projects with, you know, money somehow, whether that's developer-driven or public dollars. And a lot of these projects will probably be public dollars because they're in existing areas. And I think that within those limitations, there are certainly places, you know, I would love to see bike lanes on 13th Street, but that's just simply not going to be practical. But, you know, if we can get a parallel route, for example, that on the, along there, maybe on 16th Street or down to 9th Street, you know, that offers people a way to get through that area of the community and completes a network along with north-south routes that can get us around the need to ride a bike directly on 13th Street. Mm-hmm. And that's what you see in a lot of communities around the country. There will be major arteries where, you know, there might be a side path to keep people off the streets, but the major bicycle routes are off of the major arteries. And that promotes a more comfortable riding environment. You know, you don't have cars whizzing past and the road noise. But it also creates a network where people in cars don't feel like their traffic is being disrupted by a bike, and it creates spaces for bicycles to get to and from wherever they need to as well.
Mm-hmm. Damien, prior to going on the air here, you were kind of referring to some of the obstacles that exist in Ames, two of them being railroads and rivers. Talk a little bit about what are the problems in Ames in terms of planning for the kind of system that Trevin's talking about.
Well, one of the challenges we've had, and this is even before my time as traffic engineer for the city, is that trying to get longer connected east-west routes where you don't have to constantly be turning and have a circuitous way to get through town have been because if you're on a trail, for instance, trying to get right-of-way, since you cannot condemn for a trail, you have to get either pay for an easement or get an easement donated. It's very difficult if a landowner does not want a trail in their property. And so we work very hard and very long sometimes to secure those easements, and it just takes time. So mm-hmm. to trying to get those connections in greenbelt areas is a very time-consuming process. And then the second is when you have barriers like creeks or railroads.
We got a lot of those.
Right. Is that any railroad is going to be a Union Pacific right-of-way. And so we have to work with them and try and see if they are willing, because we don't have a mechanism necessarily to force them, to give us a crossing. So, again, it's a very diplomatic, very lengthy process to work with the railroad to do that. And then maybe lastly what I would say is anytime you cross a bridge, anytime you cross a creek is you need to build a bridge. And just bridge infrastructure, because it could flood, it could be flooding underneath the bridge or over top the bridge, can be expensive. So we do try and we want to have a system, and we talked about that last night, that is connected, but we also have to maintain it. So if we build a really expensive system that's well connected now, we happen to come up with the money.
How much does it cost to build a bridge?
Well, a ped bridge, like we don't expect vehicles to go on it, and this is very rough numbers because depending on the span, you know, you could be looking at a couple hundred thousand dollars. And a couple hundred thousand dollars is going to build you a long length of trail. So sometimes we might have a route that looks like, hey, this would be great just to cross the bridge right here, but we may only have enough money for the bridge itself and nothing to connect to it. So we really try and balance out how we spend the money in the most efficient way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But just a lot of challenges. And the good thing is we're not like Maryland, for instance, like East. We don't have nearly as many bridges and crossings that they do, but we still have our challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what do you think the probability of the plan that you're making is of really happening?
Well, I would say especially the Greenbelt Trail system will always have its challenges, but I think what we're getting a lot of, like Trevin was talking about, is that there's a lot of more interest in being more active, and active for commuting purposes and for recreation purposes. So the Greenbelt Trail system, we're seeing a lot more willingness on just community-wide to do these things. So I think getting easements is going to be easier. And then secondly, the on-street facilities, that's really just the community setting a priority about what they want to see that street to look like. So I'm thinking, since we have right-of-way, our biggest challenges might be getting an on-street system is anything in the right-of-way that might be affected. So our biggest challenge might be getting, like, parking, dealing with parking, or dealing with if there's, like, trees or other things in the right-of-way that might be affected. We'll have to have those discussions. But
so when you say dealing with parking, in a way you're saying that parking would be sacrificed?
I'm saying it might be. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be prepared for what we want to give and take to mm-hmm. try and get some cycling infrastructure on certain corridors. But I think there, again, just community-wide, there seems to be a lot of excitement about getting these things in. So I think if you look 5 years ago, it might be a little more of a challenge than I think it will be moving forward. But mm-hmm. so to answer your question, I think it is very doable. And I think what we got to try and do is just kind of keep the discussion open and going about it.
Trevin, what would you say is a priority?
Well, I think less specific areas and more sustained routes. Even with the challenges in Ames, there are clear north-south routes that you can take in a car. You can take University to Stang, and those two roads will get you the length of town through the middle. You can take Duff and Grand, or just Duff, to get north-south all the way through. And 13th Street in Ontario can get you east-west, and Lincoln Way can do the same. So even with some of the more circuitous routes that we have, 16th to University to Mortenson, there are east-west and north-south routes in Ames. Getting some of those sustained routes through town, I would say, is the Bike Coalition's biggest priority. And then I think the next priority, which is a very close second, is trying to make sure that we're continuing to expand protected facilities. You know, we have a lot of shared use paths, which offer a high degree of protection. But in certain areas, like, for example, Ontario, where there are a lot of driveways, they don't actually offer a lot of safety. Along mm-hmm. Stang, where there's very few intersections mm-hmm. and no driveways to speak of, that's a great facility to have alongside that road. So we need to be talking about things like protected bike lanes. And there are lots of ways you can do that. You can do that with as little as paint, and you create a 2 or 3 foot buffer where, you know, there's effectively a no man's land between the bike lanes and cars, and that shy area makes everyone feel a little bit more comfortable. Or you can do it with a much smaller space with a more physical barrier, and that can be everything from barrier that stands 2 or 3 feet above the roadway, concrete jersey barriers, which is probably the ugliest option, there are planters, but all the way down to really inexpensive options like plastic bollards. You see this in a lot of new protected facilities around the country today. You know, it's just a plastic cone that's permanently affixed to the roadway that separates bikes and cars, and actually does provide a great deal of separation and protection and comfort. And the key here being these interconnected routes and these protected facilities make all bicycle users comfortable. Something we see a lot in literature and research around this is roughly 10% of the population that feels comfortable riding their bikes in most conditions need minimal facilities, probably feel comfortable with an on-street lane with no protection. But there's a much larger percentage of the population, probably going up to as much as 2/3 of the population, that is only going to feel comfortable commuting regularly if they can easily find a route to where they need to go. That's that north-south continuous route and east-west continuous route issue, and that they feel protected and safe. And that's where protected facilities come into play. So mm-hmm. in some places, that's going to mean new side paths, and those are more expensive than an on-street route. And in some places, that's going to mean we're going to need protected facilities.
Damien, can you tell us where the plan is available online?
It'd be on AimesMobility2040.com.
Say that again.
AimesMobility2040. local2040.com, all one word.
Well, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and we're speaking with Damian Pregitzer, Chief Traffic Engineer for the City of Ames, and Trevin Ward from the Ames Bicycle Coalition about recommendations for the long-range transportation plan on how to manage the future of cycling in Ames and surrounding areas. The plan was presented yesterday. Thank you for coming and sharing this information with us. And as usual, there's always so much more to talk about, but we're running out of time, so it's time for Tuning Into Agriculture.
Hello, this is Jim Warble.
And my name is Delphine Douglas.
She's my wife. I am a producer for Local Talk Radio. And I'm talking today about one of my favorite fall activities, which is foraging for mushrooms.
Yum, yum.
Many people are familiar with morels in the spring. And so lots of people go out in the spring and looking for morel mushrooms. And I like morel mushrooms, too. But fall is also one of my favorite seasons to be looking for mushrooms.
Well, we're a lot more successful in the fall.
Morels are hard to find. So many of you are familiar with one of the more common fall mushrooms, which is a puffball. It's those frequently you'll see them growing in a pasture or something like that. It's a big white mushroom. A lot of kids, you would kick them around and things like that. They're very good, very simple. They're like tofu. They take whatever taste they're cooked with. They're delicious.
But there are some others that really carry a taste quality that excite me a lot more than a puffball. Chicken in the woods, hen in the woods.
One of my favorites is bear's head. Yesterday, what did we find yesterday in the woods, Delphine?
Well, we found some shaggy manes growing all around this huge ancient tree, and it's now become part of a potato soup for supper tonight.
And I had a taste of it, and it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of fall mushrooms that most people are not familiar with.
Oh, and there's the bouncy ones, the wood ear that are going into our miso soup. Yeah.
There's a lot of really good fall mushrooms. So how do you learn to find out what mushrooms to eat? There's a lot of mushrooms that you really shouldn't eat. Never eat a mushroom that you are not familiar with.
Well, we joined the Prairie States Mushroom Club last year. So we got together with some of those folk, and that was crucially helpful to feel more confident about what we were getting and ingesting. And we have a couple of books, and every now and then Google something, learned how to make spore prints. That's really beautiful artwork to help identify mushrooms. But there's some mushrooms that are a lot easier to identify. Your chicken in the woods and wood ear and hen in the woods, some of those, they're easy to identify. So you feel more confident with that.
Most of the mushrooms that we look for in the fall have very few lookalikes. So there's one that's called a honey mushroom, and it's kind of related to the deadly gallerina. And if you don't really kind of know what you're eating, you can eat a deadly gallerina. It's just not worth the risk. So we don't eat brown mushrooms. So there are different ways to learn about the fall mushrooms to gather. One is to, as we said, as we've done, we've gone out with Prairie States Mushroom Club. The other is to go out with other people. There's a lot of people in Ames who are kind of quiet about it, but if you ask around, there's a lot of people who know a little bit about mushrooms and which mushrooms are good to eat and which ones are not good to eat. You'd be surprised how many people know once you start putting the word out.
Let's go shrooming, right?
Last year, the Story County Conservation had a mushroom hunt at McFarland Park. So pay attention to your Story County conservation hikes every now and then. These people are very knowledgeable about mushrooms and can be a great source for information about which mushrooms are good to eat.
And then the Arboretum had a log inoculating workshop And there were two kinds of oyster mushrooms that we inoculated spores. And so now mycelium is growing all in those logs. And someday, year, they're going to pop out.
Just as a small factoid for all of you people, are you aware that the real mushroom is growing underground or in a log, and it's usually got all these white tentacles, roots, whatever, and that's the real mushroom. And what we see popping up out of the ground is really the fruit of the mushroom. Uh-huh. So it's the equivalent is that you see a tree, and that's the mycelium, and what we see is the fruit equivalent. So when you get an apple or a pear, that would be what the equivalent to what a mushroom is like.
So that makes me feel better when I pick something that I know that the mycelium, the root structure, the whole big organism is still within the tree
or
in the ground, whatever.
So I encourage people this fall, if you're in a mature woods, to just go out and round and looking for mushrooms. It gives you something kind of fun to do when you're out maybe looking for hickory nuts or whatever and just going around and seeing, because there are all sorts of beautiful mushrooms. If you want, then you can Google and try to figure out what these mushrooms are or talk to somebody. There's also an expert at Iowa State University that can help you to identify common mushrooms.
Don't eat chicken in the woods with wine.
What happens is that there's a substance called coprine, which makes it difficult for us to process alcohol in our bodies. So a little alcohol can give you a bad hangover if you combine it with the wrong mushrooms. So you need to be very careful sometimes about what you're eating with wine. Any final comments, Delphine?
For me, it's brought more interest into my exploration of the woods, because I tend to be more exploring the prairies and identifying those things. But getting into the woods, it's given me a different focus and interest of what to explore and look for in the woods. It gets really, really exciting when I see something in the distance and I'm racing because I know that's going to be chicken in the woods.
My comment is that I like to go hiking in the woods in the fall. It's a gorgeous time to go hiking in the woods. And if you happen to find a mushroom, it even makes it more spectacular. Sometimes I have a stare down with a deer, or I'll find some other creature or some birds doing a lovely tune. And it's just a good reason to get out in the woods. And if you happen to find a mushroom that's edible, it's even better.
Thank you for tuning in to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, and thank you to the show's guests, Lisa Hine from the Iowa Heritage Foundation, Damian Pregitzer, Chief Traffic Engineer for the City of Ames, and Trevin Ward from the Ames Bicycle Coalition. Thanks also to KHOI reporter Jim Werbel and Delphine Douglas for telling us about the shrooms this week. Local Talk is on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. You can also hear today's show on our website, KHOIFM.org. That's KHOIFM.org. There you'll also find information and links to the people and things you heard about today on the show with contact information. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Thank you, Jonah. Hope school's going well. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards and from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The Happy Farmer by Robert Schumann. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team of volunteer reporters. We'll train you. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or through our website, KHOIFM.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, and remember, your participation as the audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.